Welcome, welcome, welcome to Studio 2 in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Lots to talk about on today's show.
Let's talk about what we're talking about.
Yeah, later this segment, we're going to be talking about sewage water.
Mm.
I know, sexy topic, but it's actually very fascinating.
It is. Because don't undersell sewage.
Because when it rains a lot, we have an overflow of water and sewage can end up in our waterways. And Philadelphia has been working to help fix the problem. And the initiative that they put forward was a crown jewel in the city's cap. You know, it was called Green City, Clean Water. But apparently there's some issues. And we're going to be talking about that issue with a reporter, Kyle Bagenstos. He wrote a very deep dive piece in Grid Magazine, fascinating piece, and we'll be talking about that as our newsmaker. Also, the Boy Scouts pretty soon is going to have a new name.
Scouting America.
And this comes after a number of controversies, financial issues, lawsuits. And we're going to be talking about the history specifically of LGBT activism within the Boy Scouts with the author of Morally Straight, How the Fight for LGBTQ plus Inclusion Changed the Boy Scouts and America. Fascinating read.
Yeah, and if you have thoughts on the Boy Scouts, maybe you were a scout yourself, maybe you're involved in the scouts somehow, maybe you're just on the outside looking in, but you're very intrigued about what's happening with the Boy Scouts of America, email us, studio2@whyy.org. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. And then the last segment today is a tech-related segment.
Yes.
All about the marriage of Apple and artificial intelligence. Siri is getting smarter. Maybe.
Maybe. Question mark.
We think. Or maybe it's just a business play.
Yeah.
That's what we have to find out from a New York Times reporter at the end of the show today. But first, let's dig into some headlines, Cherry. This broke late yesterday after our show. 8 foreign nationals with suspected ties to ISIS were arrested in coordinated raids in Philadelphia, New York, and Los Angeles. This is according to federal authorities. Details are scant right now. Mm-hmm. We don't know the names of these people. We don't really know what they're being charged with. Here is what officials are telling us, that they're originally from Tajikistan, which is a country in Central Asia. They entered the U.S. illegally through the southern border in 2023 and made asylum claims, and that these 8 individuals were arrested, some number of them in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
That's what we know so far. Obviously, tons of questions will sprawl out from this. We don't really have the answers at this moment.
No, the thing that was a red flag to me was that these individuals were preliminarily vetted at the southern border, and they were allowed to stay in the United States, you know, pending asylum hearings. But then, of course, later on, it was determined that there was possible connections to ISIS. But, you know, you have a lot of people coming through that southern border, and this comes as, you know, President Joe Biden issued an executive order sort of closing the border right now because of folks who have been coming through.
National security officials have been raising alarms specifically about growing radicalism in this part of the world connected to ISIS and an ISIS offshoot called ISIS-K. And so this does fit in with a pattern that we've seen elsewhere in the world. We've seen folks from this part of the world carry out terrorist attacks in Russia, and there have been increased warnings from U.S. officials about the possibility here. So it is something to be vigilant about, and it does intersect with this larger debate about immigration. You can't deny that. And so, of course, more questions than answers at this point, but we want to be aware of it. It happened in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and moving on, SEPTA has received an award for safety.
Okay.
Yeah, it's called the Gold Award. It's for rail security, and it was given by the American Public Transportation Association. It's one of their highest honors, and it goes to transit companies for their efforts to improve safety and security. You're probably like thinking to yourself, what? I thought all kinds of craziness was going on SEPTA. Are they getting this award? People in the world, because there was some reporting done where folks were asked on the street, can you believe SEPTA got this award? But the numbers are fairly good.
That's kind of a setup to ask that question, but okay.
From January to March of this year, SEPTA saw a 45% decrease in serious crimes compared to the same period last year. They've hired 45 new safety officers. And, you know, that award is based on effectiveness and innovation, among other criteria. So there's been a lot of moves made by SEPTA. But decrease in serious crimes doesn't necessarily mean that people feel safer. And so, you know, some reporting was done where folks were sort of asked, do they feel safe?
Sometimes reputation lags behind reality. That's not surprising.
Absolutely. And people's perception, it takes a little time to change that. But kudos to SEPTA. I mean, making some moves, and they got this APTA award.
Kudos also to the James Beard Media Award winners. James Beard Awards, you've heard of them. They're like the Oscars of food. Last year was a huge year for Philadelphia. We got like best restaurant and best restaurateur nationally. This year, Philly didn't do so well, but
we still represented.
We still represented, and we wanted to note that South Jersey bartender Danny Childs won for his book Slow Drinks. And it's not just about cocktails, I'm told. It's about foraging for the ingredients and fermenting them yourself, even for non-alcoholic drinks
level.
Like botanical soda. So if you really want to invest in that cocktail, check out Slow Drinks by Danny Childs, a winner of the James Beard Media Awards, a South Jersey bartender, and a graduate of the great University of Delaware.
All right. So, Avi.
More food.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's warm outside. And there's a sticky, greasy pole in the Italian market in South Philly where there's cheese and meat that has been baking in the sun for weeks. The best part, like I said, been hanging there for about 4 weeks now.
Backtrack. What are we talking about?
It was part of the Italian Market Festival, which took place almost a month ago. People were climbing the greasy pole as a tradition. They wanted to sort of grab provolone balls and cured soppressata, and then they would throw it down to the crowds below them, right?
That's an annual tradition
as part of it. I used to live in South Philly, go to the Italian Market.
Yeah,
you know?
It's the grease pole competition. I know what you're talking about.
But basically what happened was not all of the meat and cheese was, you know, gotten.
It's hard to get to the top. Yeah.
And so they forgot to take it all down. And so that meat and cheese has just been sitting there like roasting because it's been hot, you know, a number of days.
That sounds delicious.
And it probably smells delicious-ish. Mm. I don't know. But the market usually takes them down, but they need a crane. And they said this time they put it exceptionally high, which is why folks sort of forgot to go get it. And I know you live in South Philly. I'm not sure if you can smell it.
I haven't smelled it. I didn't even notice it. I walk by it all the time. But maybe someone will take that finely cured meat and cheese.
Oh, my goodness.
Take it down from the pole, do something innovative with it, and win a James Beard Award next year.
Yeah, I mean, that could be some special meat.
That's called a callback, Cherry Gregg.
All right.
And let's move on. One more story today. We wanted to shout out a North Philly native, WNBA superstar, and now an Olympian.
Aw.
Kalia Copper from North Philadelphia was recently named to the USA women's basketball team for the Paris Olympics. If you don't know her, she's amazing. 29 years old, just an absolute superstar. Played college at Rutgers. Like I said, is from North Philly. Almost made it for Tokyo. Didn't quite make it, but now she is going to be an Olympian. And chances are she's going to win a gold medal because the USA dominates this competition. They're like one of the best teams in any sport in the world, in any competition, the USA women's basketball team. So shout out Kalia Copper. You are an Olympian, and we in Philadelphia are proud of you.
Yay. Congratulations, Kalia. And by the way, Philly needs our WNBA team. Anytime I get to say that, I'm going to keep saying it. So.
Can I say one more thing about this? Kalia Copper played some of her high school career at Girard College in North Philadelphia. If you know anything about the history of that school, for years and years and years, it was all white and all male by decree. And people fought very, very hard to integrate that school. And the fact that someone who went to Girard College, a black woman, is going to be representing Philadelphia on the world stage is a wonderful thing. And I think it validates the hard work of all those many people over many, many years. So shout out to the pioneers at Girard College.
And we'll definitely be watching. And you can always support her by watching the Phoenix Mercury as well.
Yes, that's where she plays in the WNBA.
She's a guard there. So we're going to jump into our newsmaker segment. Like many cities, Philly has a water problem. When it rains, sewers overflow, which means raw sewage ends up in our waterways. The conventional way to fix this is pretty simple. Build big tunnels to capture and store the sewage. But Philadelphia, well, we chose a different path.
Way back in 2011, the city pitched a unique plan to build thousands of little landscape improvements to capture this rainwater, you know, before it inundated the sewer system. This was hailed as innovative, even a national model. But there's growing evidence that this project contained grave miscalculations.
It's called Green City, Clean Waters, and our next guest dove deep into this project and what it means for Philly if our officials, if they got it wrong. Kyle Bagenstos is a freelance journalist based in Philadelphia and joins us now to talk about his recent article in Grit magazine all about this topic. Kyle, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Kyle, let's start with the problem. Why does Philadelphia have to fix its sewer system? What's wrong with the way that it works now and has worked in the past?
So Philadelphia is an old city, and like a lot of cities, it has something called a combined sewer. So I think the easiest way to think about this is two pipes in the street. Right. One carries the sewage you flush. One carries the stormwater from the street. That's how modern cities and water construction is done. In Philly, the pipe is the same. It's combined. And so what happens is when there's a hard rainstorm or sometimes even a light rain in certain situations, that fills up the pipe and there's not room for the sewage in there as well. So two things can happen. The sewage can either overflow out of the end of pipe into the Schuylkill and the Delaware or into other water on other waterways, or it can actually back up into the basements of homes that are on that sewer line, because once again, there's no place for it to go. So this is a big problem dealt by a lot of big cities, Chicago, New York, any old city in America has this problem, and the Environmental Protection Agency requires cities to fix it.
Mm. And there's pollutants in that water. I mean, what does it do to waterways when this sewage gets dumped into them?
Yeah, it's raw sewage. So, you know, that's not a very safe thing. And when it gets into the waterways, it can harm ecosystems, right? It can harm the water itself, kind of mess up the oxygen levels, harm ecosystems. It can also make the water unsafe for recreation. So there's some estimates that up to 100 days a year or more in Philadelphia, people can't boat on the river. They can't fish on the river because there's unsafe level of these contaminants in the water.
Yeah, and so two fixes typically, or well, now there are two fixes, but the typical way to fix this problem or to deal with it was to build tunnels, and cities have done that. How would the tunnel system work?
Yeah, so the tunnel's what it sounds like. It's a big tunnel. Usually it can be up to 20 feet wide or more. They can stretch for miles. And basically what cities often do is they just drill down and then drill sideways underneath the city to have these large tunnels that store all the excess water during the storm and then pump it out afterward once the treatment plant has capacity.
And then Philadelphia, we chose a different path. We wanted to do, it was very innovative. Explain the Philadelphia process with Green City.
Yeah, so Philly really was the first and I think still only city in the country to take this green approach where instead of doing the tunnels, they were going to install thousands of pieces of green infrastructure around the city. Most people probably see them walking around the city every day. Rain gardens, little tree trenches, you know, lines of trees along the street. Mm. And the idea was these things were going to hold that stormwater in place, never let it get to the sewer in the first place to cause the problem. So it was, the first city to really take this majority approach where it's spending the majority of the billions of dollars it's spending installing this green infrastructure. Mm.
So this stuff captures the rain, it holds the rain, and therefore this combined sewer system works as it should and the rivers stay clean.
That's the idea.
That's the idea.
Or at least greatly reduces it.
Yeah.
It's never going to capture it all. Even the tunnels don't capture everything, but greatly reduce the amount of sewage going into waterways.
So when they pitched this idea, what was it supposed to cost? How long was it supposed to take?
The original estimate, so it's a 25-year plan from 2011, so that goes to 2036. The original estimate was $2.4 billion to do this over 25 years. And what my recent reporting shows is that there's now the estimate is $4.5 billion. So we're talking about a $2.1 billion increase over the original estimate.
What's driving this uptick in cost?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell, right? I can only rely on my sources and the documentation that they provided me, but it looks like they're basically just running implementation trouble. You know, this is a new innovative program. It hasn't been done before. And this is somewhat controversial about just how much of a problem there is. But what I understand is basically the implementation problems are that the designs take longer and cost more. The actual installation costs to install these different rain gardens and things cost more. And the maintenance costs more, right? So you got to take care of the vegetation. Sometimes the vegetation can get overwhelmed or die because of poor soil quality. So the idea is that, you know, there's basically these implementation challenges that are just driving up the cost.
Mm. Yeah. And you spoke with some people inside the water department who seem pretty concerned. And I think you even mentioned that maybe there's become this split in the water department, people who are still true believers in this innovative approach and people who are seeing the cracks. Describe the dynamic as best you can tell from the people who are still trying to implement this. Yeah.
My understanding is this has been a pretty controversial thing from the very start. I talked to a former EPA official for the story who said that right from the get-go that there were concerns within that agency. I know a little bit less about PWD, the Philadelphia Water Department, but what I gather, you have similar kinds of things where some people really agree with it and some people don't. I think a lot of times everyone, for the most part, understands there's value to green infrastructure. I don't think anybody says that this stuff is just worthless. I think the conversation is around to what degree, right? What's the right mix? How much green versus how much what we call gray, the tunnel approach? What is the right mix to do? And I think what the critics are saying is that Philadelphia's majority green approach doesn't seem to be working out, and maybe it should be the department should be thinking about shifting back more towards the tunnel. Exactly where that right mix is going to, you know, change person to person.
What do you think it would take for the city to pivot? Because there's this mandate from the EPA that by 2036, we have a certain number of green space. Will we make it? And I mean, given all the delays and the increased costs.
Yeah. Once again, the Philadelphia Water Department's a huge institution. You know, it's tough to tell. It seems like at least who's ever answering my questions at the moment, if you want to peg that to leadership or whatever it may be, is pretty confident this program is working. They, I think, kind of file a lot of these things under bumps in the road that they're going to make adjustments to do. So in terms of what would force a pivot, I'm not really sure. I don't know. Obviously, there's somebody inside PWD would decide that they want to pivot. The EPA and the DEP, which is the State Department of Environmental Protection, you know, they have oversight of this. I could suppose that either one of those agencies could really start trying to move the ship on this. There's agreement in place, which kind of complicates things. You have to reopen the agreement. I will say also in this 25-year plan, there are certain goals or thresholds the city's supposed to hit every 5 years. And so I think if some of the bigger targets start to get missed in one of those things, maybe that could potentially be important.
And quick question, we pay for stormwater management on our water bill. Could this all impact how much we as individuals pay for our water?
I mean, I think that's the primary thrust of the reporting, right? So as I understand it, the majority of this program is paid for, as you said, on the water bills, right? I think the city tries to get funding where they can. I think they try and some of this, there's some regulations to try and get private, landowners to do some of this stuff. But a lot of it comes to that stormwater fee on the annual bill. I actually did the math coming in today, $4.5 billion divided by 1.5 million Philadelphians is $3,000 per Philadelphian.
So wow.
You times that by, family of four, it gets up there. Like I said, now not every dollar is being spent by the bills, but it's, relative. Yeah.
And before we wrap up here, have about 30 seconds left. I mean, what are the consequences if this ends up being a big miss?
Yeah. We're at the halfway point of the plan right now, right? So money's already been invested. I think the risk is, if this is correct, the program's not working out, and as some critics say, won't work on the back half too. We get to 2036. We've spent, it seems, at least $4.5 billion, and we didn't fix the problem. And the EPA comes in and says, you got to do it again. And now we're spending additional dollars to maybe do something like a tunnel. That's the risk if it doesn't work.
Wow. Big stakes. Thank you so much. Kyle Bagenstos, freelance journalist based here in Philadelphia. His recent article published in Grid Magazine investigates the Green City Clean Waters Project. Thanks so much for your time, Kyle.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Boy Scouts of America.
Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
We're the ball.
And with that roaring welcome, you're back in Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarant.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The Boy Scouts of America has shaped the American landscape as well as the lives of many children for more than 100 years. But the organization has a problematic history as well. sexual abuse, financial troubles, and discrimination based on gender or sexual orientation.
Just last month, the Boy Scouts of America announced they are rebranding as Scouting America beginning in February 2025. This is all part of an attempt to be more welcoming. Here to talk about the Boy Scouts is journalist and writer Mike DeSocio. He published a new book last week called Morally Straight: How the Fight for LGBTQ Plus Inclusion Changed the Boy Scouts and America. Mike, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Scouts, we want to hear from you. Were you a boy or a Girl Scout? How did this Boy Scouts shape your childhood? What do you think about the renaming? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Mike, you have a personal relationship with this story in addition to writing the book. You're a scout. Would you say you're a scout, a former scout? How would you define it?
Yeah, I would say I was a former scout. I spent almost my entire life in the program, joined as a Cub Scout in first grade, went all the way through Eagle Scout rank, and then spent the better part of my 20s volunteering for the Scouts. It's been a couple years since I volunteered, but basically from age 25 to 28, I was involved in scouting.
And what drew you to it?
You know, I think I liked it for the same reason a lot of kids like it. I loved being outdoors. I loved the activities. But more than that, as kind of an outcast growing up to some extent, I wasn't popular in school. I never excelled at sports. I found scouting to be the place where I did fit in. Even before I came to understand myself as a queer individual, it just felt like this more expansive space where I could succeed.
Yeah, let's talk about the history of the Boy Scouts. I mean, the Boy Scouts was founded in 1910. It was an idea that was taken from a scouting organization based in the UK. What do you know about the history of the group?
That's right. So the global movement originated in the UK. It was founded by a man named Robert Baden Powell, who sort of looked around and thought that the boys of that generation needed a bit more moral character. And I think he was essentially trying to breed boys to become military men. That was the idea of scouting for boys, as the original handbook was called. And it made its way over to the US a couple years later when a man named W.D. Boyce liked what he saw in England and wanted to bring more or less the same program over to the US. There were a few other programs in the U.S. At the turn of the century that eventually either were absorbed into the Boy Scout program or sort of folded, and the Boy Scouts of America became the primary youth development program for boys.
What was happening in society at that time, we're talking early 20th century, that necessitated an organization like this, at least in the minds of the people who founded it?
Yeah, I think in the minds of Powell and Boyce, there was this concern that maybe boys were too soft, or there was this kind of like modernity that was, you know, changing the way people were growing up and being raised. And I think they wanted to pivot back toward traditionalism, again, instill this traditional idea of character, and again, make people that would maybe join the military or be involved in government and kind of be the leaders of that generation that they wanted to see.
And so the Boy Scouts was based on certain principles and rules, including an oath. And the title of your book, Morally Straight, this phrase comes up quite often. Tell me what sort of like some the oath and this term, what did it mean?
Right. So the scout is something that scouts recite at every single scout meeting. And one of the phrases is that scouts should be physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight. And from the very founding in 1910, morally straight just meant to be a good person, basically, to be honest in your relationships and about yourself. But once upon a time, when the Boy Scouts decided they wanted to keep out gay members, they started to weaponize this phrase. And in court, they argued that morally straight actually meant straight, as we understand it now, heterosexual, and tried to use that as proof that from the very beginning, gay people weren't allowed. It wasn't part of the moral character of the organization. But again, that phrase really was always understood and was defined in the handbook in a more general way, just again, about how to be a good person.
Mm. Before we get to the 1970s, when the Boy Scouts passed this blanket ban on gay members, I want to understand its ascent. So how does it go from this idea in 1910 to this massive organization? Why is it so popular? Who does it appeal to? And what types of official support does it get along the way to aid that growth?
Yeah, it gets official support really early on. It gets chartered by Congress in the 1910s.
Which is really rare, right? Chartered
right.
by Congress.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So a ton of official government support right off the bat. And it started courting a lot of churches. So something that's unique about the Boy Scouts of America compared to other scouting organizations is that each troop is sponsored by a third party. either a church or a civic group. And so they courted all kinds of churches, Catholic, Protestant, all sorts of religious
groups.
That's
like a network that already exists
exactly.
that we can tap into.
Exactly. And so then the youth involved in the church became involved in the Boy Scouts. And the kind of peak of membership occurred in the mid-century, basically after World War II with the baby boom, and led to the ultimate peak in membership in the early 70s. I think it really appealed to this kind of patriotic post-war attitude, and that was really the golden age of scouting.
Yeah, it's the Cold War. It's just something that feels very American. I mean,
Absolutely.
That's kind of what I was reading into it.
Yeah, I think it just felt like the quintessentially American thing to do, and why wouldn't you want to put your son into that, right?
Yeah, and the membership swelled. I mean, well over a million. And 71%, more than 71% of units were chartered by faith-based organizations. How baked in was this, the religious ideals, into the backbone of what Boy Scouts of America was?
Yeah, so the Boy Scouts from the beginning always had this declaration of religious principle that has been required of every scout. And so it doesn't require a scout to belong to a particular religion, but it does require that they declare a belief in some kind of higher power. So for the scouts that were involved in a church-sponsored troop, they could, you know, declare a belief in that religion or any religion for that matter. The one thing you couldn't do was declare yourself to be an atheist, but I think the level of religion in each troop really varied. I grew up in a troop that was sponsored by a parent-teacher association, so religion was almost non-existent in my troop. But for others, for example, the troop sponsored by the Mormon Church, they were almost one and the same, and the two groups really meshed deeply.
And they were big, the Church of the Latter-day Saints, yeah.
That's right. The Church of Latter-day Saints accounted for more than a third of membership at one point. They sort of sanctioned the Boy Scouts of America program as the official program for boys in the Mormon Church. And so, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of Mormon boys involved for a really long time.
And so could you take us to 1978? And that was a time before 1978, there was no explicit ban on having gay individuals in the Boy Scouts. What changed that? What precipitated the ban?
Yeah, it almost came about by accident. There was these two teenage boys in a small town in Minnesota who came out to each other as gay, and their scout leader kind of caught wind of it and revoked their membership in 1978. And the two boys protested this, and there was actually an Associated Press reporter at their protest, and so it became this national story, which sort of forced the Boy Scouts to respond. At first, they just said, we support this local unit leader's discretion to make decisions. But then they were sort of forced to stake out an official policy. And this was a bit of a delicate time for the Boy Scouts. They were struggling as an organization to stay relevant. There was actually a lot of backlash toward the gay community at this point. The early 70s were a period of success for the gay rights movement. And then by the late 70s, there was this backlash, much like we're seeing now, a lot of rhetoric about protecting children, like we're seeing now. And so the Boy Scouts, in reaction to these two boys in Minnesota and all the questions that it raised, threw their lot in with that side that was saying, we need to protect kids from gay people, and they banned gay youth and adults from the organization.
Wow. What was the effect on the organization in the near term and the long term of this ban?
So at first, a lot of people didn't know the ban existed because it was actually just communicated to scout executives and not to the broader membership. So it was stealthy for a long time, but as early as the 80s, people started to challenge it in court. Tim Curran was the first gay Eagle Scout to do so. And basically from the 80s all the way up to the year 2000, when it ended up in the Supreme Court, there were legal battles over this. So that was, you know, two decades of reputational damage. And as we know, it didn't end there. The policies didn't change until 2013. So although at first the policy was not widely known, it sort of became the defining debate of the Boy Scouts over the long term and consumed decades of conversation.
And they clung to it. I mean, they fought
they really
this
did.
Thing up to the U.S. Supreme Court, won in the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, so talk first about their insistence on sticking with this policy and then what ultimately caused them to reverse it.
Yeah, they really clung to it hard, and they came up with a lot of different legal arguments along the way. Like I said, one of them was about this idea of being morally straight. In the Supreme Court, they sort of prevailed on this idea that the First Amendment gave them a right as a private organization to choose their own membership. And I think their stance got less popular over time. Even in the year 2000 at the Supreme Court, there were quite a lot of Americans who disagreed with the stance that they were taking. And almost immediately after the Supreme Court victory, they started to see the consequences. A lot of sponsoring units pulled out, and there were actually a lot of smaller lawsuits over that issue. What ultimately changed the policy in the 2010s was this sort of resurgent campaign that, instead of using legal pressure, used media pressure. So this was kind of the era of online petitions and change.org. They were able to gather millions of petitions, these activists, and they ultimately put so much pressure and so much negative press on the Boy Scouts that within a couple of years, they changed their policies.
Won the legal battle but lost the war, essentially.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. I want to bring in a caller. Lucy from Blackwood, New Jersey, wants to talk about how Scout status helped her. Lucy, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that we came from a scouting family. My sister and I were Girl Scouts, and my father was an Eagle Scout and encouraged my son to be an Eagle Scout, his grandson. So that has really helped him in his college resumes because it's a leadership development capability. So he was able to develop leadership skills, and it was seen as a positive thing. So as he got the Eagle Scout, he was right alongside with people like John Glenn, other senators who had Eagle Scouts, and all of that promoted him in the college resume, as I said, and in his ability to be an RA in college.
Wow.
And go on to get scholarships and an MBA from Wharton. So it was a great way to start the leadership capabilities.
Yes.
Because they had to do their end project. His was to collect library books for the Salvation Army in Kansas City. So there's lots of opportunities, and I think you can look at the positive natures of leadership development. However, the Scouts want to now define that. Leadership development was excellent. So it moved him in his high school, in college, and in his profession.
Well, thank you for that call. Thank you very much for that call,
thank
Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy. And I have a follow-up question to that, actually, because so many people here, we have quite a few comments. People talk about Boy Scouts. Charlie, Troop 22, Unionville, Pennsylvania, says Boy Scouts has been one of the most informative and empowering experiences of my childhood. So I want to talk about the impact that this ban had on people, because people would become Eagle Scout and then, you know, come out, go to college. I think, you know, get someone find out that they were openly gay, and all of a sudden have all of this work that they did snatched from them.
Absolutely.
Talk about the impact that that ban had on individual folks who spent their entire childhood and young adulthood in Boy Scouts.
This is absolutely one of the most tragic things about this story. I take the caller's point that scouting can be extremely formative and positive. It was for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then because this policy was so stealthy for a long time, even throughout the court cases, you know, most kids are not paying attention to that sort of thing. Most kids join scouting before they have a conception of their sexuality.
And you didn't know.
Right.
That
I didn't
the ban
know either.
Existed. Yeah.
I didn't know until after I became an Eagle Scout in 2011 that the ban existed. And so it was so common. I found this over and over again in my reporting, for people to have that conflict, to have, you know, an incredibly positive and formative experience. And then all of a sudden, whether it was before they became an Eagle Scout, there were a lot of people kicked out before that point, which is devastating, or after, when they tried to continue volunteering as an adult and then, again, got rejected or discovered the policy and thought, wait a second, this doesn't really fit with what I learned in the program. And that's a really heartbreaking and devastating thing, to have the organization that taught you morality turn around and say, oh, wait, we learned this one thing about you, and now you're not moral.
You mentioned that comment from Charlie, Troop 22, Unionville, PA. I just wanted to add that Charlie also wrote, I'm happy to know my experiences will now be accessible to all children regardless of gender identity, and hope more will join and become engaged leaders in America's future. Nicholas also emails, I reached Eagle Scout rank in May 2003 in Connecticut. I am happy that scouting has allowed openly LGBT youth and adults as well as women in the organization. It was bound to happen. The amount of naysayers that say that scouting should stay what it was originally for boys and girls separate need to do their research. This is not the 1950s. So what is BSA, soon to be Scouting America, trying to do now, Mike? First of all, maybe also say about the existential challenges they face.
Yes.
But what are they trying to do moving forward with this revamp?
Yeah, so the existential challenges are pretty significant. They just emerged from a $2.5 billion bankruptcy settlement to compensate victims of sexual abuse over the history of the organization. There were 80,000 survivors that came forward within that process. They also lost about half of their membership during COVID. I think some of that is directly due to the pandemic. Some of it probably is due to the reputation damage as well. So they're at a really fragile point in their history right now. And they have also now opened their doors to basically everyone. So I think what they're trying to do is, in a way, play catch-up. A lot of their peer organizations have been co-ed for a long time, have accepted LGBTQ members for a very long time. But the BSA has really only been in that boat for about 5 years now since admitting girls. So I think they're opening the doors wide and hoping that it leads to a uptick in membership.
Yeah. Jill emails, I was in the Girl Scouts and hated it, found it very boring doing domestic activities and wanted so badly to do the things the Boy Scouts was doing. I was about 10 to 12. This was around 1998 to 2000. My mom tried desperately to get me signed up, but they refused to let me join as I was a girl. Jill, things have changed now. How is it impacting membership at this point? Has there been a change?
Yeah, there has been a slight uptick. The low point was around 2021, 2022, and now there's a very small movement in the other direction. And I think the person who wrote in here makes a really good point. One of the activists that actually led to the inclusion of girls, someone named Sydney Ireland, had the exact same experience. Her brother was in the Boy Scouts, and she said, I never had interest in the Girl Scouts. I didn't want their program. I wanted the Boy Scout program. And she actually became the first female Eagle Scout because partly due to her activism, they changed the policy just in time for her to jump into the program and complete all of the ranks.
Wow.
Tom has a question. Tom emails, will they now accept atheists? You mentioned that sort of a declaration of faith is still part of the organization. So where does that leave non-believers?
I find it unlikely that they'll make an official policy change in this area. It's sort of the last frontier, but there isn't any kind of organized campaign or pressure movement to make that happen. I think there's less of a desire for that because a lot of Scouts are able to kind of skate by. You have to declare this religious principle, but if you write Buddhism...
I mean, you can fake it, essentially?
Basically, right. Yeah. If you write down something like Buddhism and your Scout leader doesn't even know where to start asking questions about that,
right.
And this is very common. I've heard many people who've done it. They just say, okay, and they move on.
So it's just not as much of a pressure point.
Right.
Okay.
Folks are generally not being kicked out because of this.
And I just want to ask one question. If you look at this lesson, this arc of activism within the Boy Scouts, is there a lesson that you think can be applied to other
Absolutely.
Areas?
I think there are so many lessons. I mean, the people who fought for LGBTQ inclusion, they endured so many losses in their campaign, and we're now in a moment where LGBTQ people are fighting for rights in so many other areas. And the challenges are much the same as they were in the 70s and 80s with legal battles, with cultural battles. And so I think these activists have a lot to teach us about the power of storytelling in these types of campaigns, about the power of insider pressure. The success of the Boy Scout campaign was because it wasn't outsiders attacking the organization. It was often gay Eagle Scouts, people who loved scouting and wanted to make it better, calling on their own organizations to live up to its principles.
Well, the book just out is called Morally Straight, How the Fight for LGBTQ Inclusion Changed the Boy Scouts and America. Its author is Mike DiSocio, writing about this topic at a particularly pertinent time because the Boy Scouts of America is changing and changing rapidly, and we'll see how successful those changes are in reviving the organization's membership. Mike, thanks so much for the time today on Studio 2, and thanks for the book.
It was a pleasure to be here.
And you'll be at Giovanni's room tonight at 6 o'clock.
Correct? That's right.
All right. You can check Mike out there. Coming up next, we're talking about Apple's AI announcement. Lots to talk about there. Stick with us. Studio 2, we'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Siri, how is AI changing smartphones and how we interact with them? She's got no idea. I got an old Apple. But here's what I do know. Apple announced this week that it is partnering with OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, to bring, quote, Apple intelligence to its phones and devices. At a conference yesterday, Apple highlighted upgrades to Siri, making the digital personal assistant more capable and natural sounding.
Your iPhone 7 definitely needs that upgrade. And other tech companies like Google and Microsoft, well, they've already added AI to their products. So if you thought you could avoid artificial intelligence, it looks like that will be nearly impossible. But what does this integration mean for users, and what does it tell us about the mainstreaming of AI? Brian Chen is the lead consumer technology reporter for the New York Times, and he joins us to explain. Brian, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, Brian, what does this actually mean for someone who picks up the next iPhone? What's going to be on it? How will it look and feel different?
So we're heading into this era of what I call the AI phone, which is a phone that takes care of everything for you by anticipating your needs. It'll do things like rewrite your emails in a different style. It'll transcribe and summarize your audio recordings. It'll even wish a friend a happy birthday by digging into your photo album for a photo of that friend, generating a fake image of that friend holding balloons and saying happy birthday. So it's going to be doing all these things for you so you can use less of your own intelligence to use the phone. And this all raises the question of, you know, how much do people really want this stuff? How much do people need this stuff? And I think it also raises the question of how much do you trust these companies to do this with your information?
Yeah, because it's cute, but also a little bit creepy, not going to lie.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, you know, is Apple simply jumping onto this AI bandwagon, or is this a defining moment in AI now that Apple's on board?
I think they're definitely jumping onto the bandwagon. The entire industry was upended by ChatGPT and OpenAI a couple years ago, and everybody's reacting to it. But as you probably know, like you mentioned earlier, Apple already had Siri, Amazon had Alexa, Google had something called Google Assistant that not very many people used. And that was what people called AI 13 years ago. Yeah. And consumers didn't really react to it. They didn't really talk to Alexa, Siri, or Google very much. They still don't. And now the question is, you know, like, so Siri's getting a brain transplant now with Apple Intelligence is what they're calling it. Are they going to talk to Siri this time? I think that's an open question. I don't really know yet.
Yeah, Siri kind of got a reputation as a more frustrating interface than a particularly useful one. Here's a clip from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Heavily edited in this clip, Larry David has an unsuccessful conversation with Siri. Let's roll it.
No, 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 you're not listening. I said Wolf's Glen Restaurant in Westwood.
A wolf's den is a habitat that provides wolves with
protection
from weather.
No, you stupid idiot. It's Wolf's Glen Restaurant in Westwood.
One option I see. J. Wolf Close.
No, no, you Wolf's Glen Restaurant!
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Oh my god, you f***ing moron!
I never get to old.
So we originally pulled that clip for an episode about cursing, but never used it, and I think you can see why. So, I mean, I think the real question that people have, Brian, at least from the consumer side, is whether this will be a substantial upgrade on the way Siri has functioned for about a decade. I mean, what's your sense of it?
I think it's too early to tell. Like you point out, you know, Siri was really hyped up as this thing that was supposed to be life-changing, and it turned out not to work very well when it finally reached the masses, and it still doesn't work very well. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. So some of this technology is coming out this fall. I think Apple's probably going to run into a lot of the same problems that a lot of companies are running into, which is what we call hallucinations. These are the new problems that artificial intelligence is running into. Oftentimes, these bots, they get things wrong and they make up facts that don't exist. You know, they hallucinate is what they call it. But I think when you think about the laundry list of new features that Apple has announced, you know, the one that sticks out to me that I would personally use is probably the audio transcriptions, probably relevant to your jobs as well, right? You know, you can record your phone calls, you can get automatic transcriptions, you can get summaries of those conversations in text form. I think, you know, if there's 100 features, then there's probably going to be one that sticks with each person eventually in the future. You know, and maybe that's all that Apple really needs to get you to keep buying new phones. That's really all that matters to Apple and Wall Street. So I think there's an open question of whether the technology is going to work very well. But they're spreading their bets. They're trying to do as many things as possible to make the phone as appealing as possible to as wide an audience as possible.
Yeah. Can we talk about Apple and OpenAI? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. Apple has always been very closed off to partnerships, and they've always been big on privacy, something that OpenAI hasn't necessarily been the best on. What does this partnership look like? And how does it, you know, connect to our privacy of our data?
I think this actually echoes Apple's partnership with Google, with Google Search. You know, like Safari has Google Search baked into it by default. And people were pointing out that this is not great for privacy either. You know, like when you do a Google search, Google sure logs a lot of that information about you doing a Google search. And that really punctured Apple's privacy stance for many years. That's what people have been pointing out. I think when Apple embraces OpenAI and ChatGPT and the iPhone, it's going to run into the same tensions of like, okay, we're a company that says we respect your privacy, but we're working with a company that has a reputation for not doing that. I think the question is, are they going to audit OpenAI and ChatGPT? Are they going to find a way to vet to see if they're following the rules and not logging your data? Because that's what the stipulation is right now, is that OpenAI and ChatGPT are allowed on iPhones because they say they're not going to log your information. How are they going to vet a third party? I don't personally know. I think a lot of people are wondering that right now. And we're going to have to see in the coming months when that partnership rolls out.
But I'm also wondering about the business play here, Brian, because Apple is this big, valuable brand. OpenAI is kind of an upstart, has a dodgy reputation. It's just surprising to me that Apple would get in bed with them, given what people think about OpenAI. And I just assume that would have, you know, ramifications for Apple's value and its reputation in the marketplace. But maybe I'm just reading it completely wrong. I mean, what's the business play here?
I think they're definitely taking a risk here, and OpenAI has really, you know, persuaded Apple to jump on board because OpenAI's technology has been so impressive, and Apple has been pressured so much by Wall Street to deliver something in artificial intelligence and play catch up. The pressure in Wall Street's eyes, or excuse me, the perception in Wall Street's eyes is that Apple had fallen behind in artificial intelligence. Everybody was doing all this different AI stuff. Apple was sitting there silent for a long time. I think that's the business play to satiate Wall Street's desires for Apple to have a response to artificial intelligence. So now they have one. The stock's gone up. You know, people are happy. They're making lots of money, and they're hoping that Apple in the long term is going to continue to sell phones. I think the long term concern for Wall Street was that the iPhone would eventually become this dumb brick that looked antiquated and useless compared to, say, Samsung phones, their main competitor. Samsung is, you know, pushing artificial intelligence a lot, and so is Google. And so now that Apple has an answer to this, you know, like, you know, Wall Street thinks Apple's going to keep selling iPhones, and that's the business. That's the business strategy.
And what's interesting to me is that with some of the AI, you had to go engage in the AI. It was another app, another thing. But this AI rollout with Apple is on devices you already have.
It's perfectly
integrated. It's going to be so integrated. Yeah. So how are we going to be able to engage it? Is it just going to be like when we do the upgrade, it'll just be on our phones?
Well, just to clarify, it's going to first be arriving on the most expensive and fastest iPhones, which is the iPhone 15 Pro, in the form of a software update coming in the fall, and that's iOS 18, and that's a free software update. So if you have that phone and you install the software update, some of these features are going to start showing up on the phone. And presumably, you know, the new Siri is going to show up on that phone, and it's going to talk differently than the old Siri. But the rest of the people who have the older, slower phones are not going to be able to access those features. I think that's going to change in the near term. You know, eventually they're probably going to roll out the AI to other iPhones. But to start with, you're going to have the fastest, most expensive phone, and then that's how they're going to upsell more expensive iPhones.
So no Siri 2.0 for me yet, Jerry.
And
Greg,
I have a 12, so that means I'm not
you're
getting
out of luck.
Either.
Brian Chen, I bet you're going to get access to this thing and get a chance to play around with it. Thanks so much for the time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Brian Chen is the lead consumer technology reporter for the New York Times, was talking to us about Apple and AI and all things future when it comes to your phone.
And Avi, I have been so excited. I thought, you know what?
I thought I was going to get it, but no.
So
you can get it.
I got to
upgrade my phone. You can write that check if you'd like.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer for today. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will call you tomorrow.
Tomorrow at noon on Studio 2, we're going to be talking with the new advice columnist, R. Eric Thomas, a friend of the show.
A friend of the show. He's taking over this massively popular, widely syndicated advice column.
Used to be called Dear Amy. Now it's Dear Eric.
Is it called Dear Eric?
It's going to be
Dear
Eric.
Is it called Dear Eric?
It's going to be called Dear Eric.
We're going to have Dear Eric on the program tomorrow. Ask Eric. We're being
ask
told
Eric.
It's called
okay,
Ask
sorry
Eric.
Sorry about that.
And we're going to ask him a bunch of questions tomorrow about the nature of giving advice. And perhaps you can write in with your own advice. You can call us, 215-351-0525.